Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our keynote panel. Today, we're going to speak about doctoral education as a site of potential epistemic justice in Australia, Aotearoa New Zealand, and South Africa, foregrounding Indigenous and transcultural knowledges and identities. My name is Professor Catherine Manathunga, and I'm from the University of the Sunshine Coast on beautiful Gubbi Gubbi country. With Professor Maria Rossetti, I co-direct the UniSC Indigenous and Transcultural Research Centre. So first of all, I'd like to begin by acknowledging Kaurna country that we are meeting on today. I pay my respects to Elders past and present, and to all First Nations peoples in the audience today. In Australia, these lands were never ceded, and I acknowledge all of the First Nations lands that you have come from, whether in Australia or abroad. In Australia, this place is a place of age-old ceremony, wisdom, and education, and I hope that this rich history and ongoing cultural dynamism will infuse our discussions today. And I would like to pass on Associate Professor Sue Stanson's best wishes to everyone in the audience today. Associate Professor Sue Stanton is the elder on our project from the Kingarakan country in the Northern Territory around Batchelor. And we call her Auntie Sue. Auntie Sue is also a elder executive advisor and at the Batchelor Institute of Indigenous Tertiary Education in the Northern Territory. So I'm a fifth generation Irish Australian with a first marriage to a Sri Lankan Australian and have a growing transcultural family who are, in my two younger generations, mostly people of colour. In my writing, I have called myself a settler invader scholar, and I have spent my whole life trying to work out what it means to be from the formerly colonised land of Ireland, living on stolen Aboriginal land. My ancestors fled colonisation and famine in Ireland to arrive in Australia in the early 19th century, but in so doing, they colonised the land now known as Australia. The image here is my time map, which is a visual methodology developed by our pilot team. I'm an historian and professor of education research, and I'm leading the ARC project that the panel is based on today. My role is to give a short introduction to how we all came to be working together. I first began working on post-colonial investigations of time, place, and cultural knowledge in doctoral education in 2007 and published a book on this in 2014. After 2014, I realised it was no longer helpful for me to be conducting this research on my own as a settler invader scholar. So I invited a number of First Nations and transcultural colleagues to join me in a pilot study called Reimagining History in Australian Doctoral Education. We then broadened our team again in 2019 to include more First Nations colleagues. Our ARC grant demonstrated how the project team operates out of two significant First Nations spaces, the UniSC Indigenous and Transcultural Research Centre and the Graduate School at Batchelor Institute. Both centres are headed by strong Aboriginal women. The project is overseen by women and men elders from a range of unceded First Nations. The First Nations team members have invited our transcultural team members located in Australia, Aotearoa, New Zealand, South Africa and China to join with them in this research. Our ARC project is entitled Implementing Indigenous Knowledge Systems in Australian Doctoral Education. So our research is designed to achieve knowledge justice for Indigenous and transcultural doctoral candidates studying in Australia. We apply three key First Nations knowledge approaches, agency on and off country, the power of story, and intercultural, iterative, and intergenerational knowledge creation to Australian doctoral education. Today we bring to you a panel that suggests some practical perspectives about how we might work towards knowledge or epistemic justice in doctoral education. We have First Nations perspectives from the land now known as Australia and from Aotearoa, New Zealand. We have transcultural perspectives from migrants to Australia, and we have a South African team of scholars, three of whom are able to be here today. So I'll now hand over to Associate Professor Catherine Gilby.
What up, everybody?
I'm going to give you the bachelor perspective. I'm going to talk about our graduate school, and I'm going to talk about there is a space that exists that doesn't preface seeking new knowledge in an Indigenous perspective, in an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander way, as deficit. Before I do, I'd like to acknowledge Professor Best and Bunda in the room. I'd like to acknowledge our two PhD, our doctoral students, Bianca and Uncle John. And we are the bedrock of the Australian research community. They just don't realise it yet. But we are. We're the oldest researchers in the world, because we have constantly been searching and researching for answers. I'm going to tell you, you're going to see some beautiful images up here of my country. I'm an Ayawadarilla. My country's northeast of Alice Springs. These are our beautiful ghost gums. These are our knowledge keepers and our grandfathers and grandmothers. And this is where we do our learning as well. And this project is all about old cultures talking with each other. It's with a great sense of gratitude that I get to walk and talk on Kaurna country as an Ayawadarilla. It's with a great sense of it's an honour to be able to talk here today from bachelor's perspective, and it's an honour to be able to talk on this unceded Kaurna land and to be welcomed as we were. Because it's not a small thing, it's a very old tradition of being welcome to walk on somebody else's country. And the opportunity to talk on somebody else's country is also not a small thing. And this whole project is about sharing that sense of gratitude, sharing that sense of knowing and being, and knowing that all people, every single step we take, we're walking on Aboriginal land. And we want to share that with our international students. We want to share that because when the old cultures talk together, we know each other. Historically, they've been shut out of this knowing. Universities haven't encouraged transcultural students, international students, to participate in the knowledge sharing that is with Aboriginal people. This whole project, I shouldn't have put the lolly in my mouth before I got up here. I thought Catherine was going to talk longer. This first slide, I'm not going to read it out because it just speaks for itself. Mr. Lingiari, Vine Deloria, and the second one, these are both just statements that don't need me to explain them because they're mic drop moments. Respect for non-Western traditions is exceedingly difficult to achieve. And that's the fundamental core of this project. Oh, this is Chaba Nyama. This is a source of sustenance for us. This is what I'm, this whole, my 5 minutes, and so give me, because I will talk too long. Read this. This is exactly what we're fighting against. Thiongo says it's the cultural bomb, but the cultural bomb doesn't exist for no reason. It exists against collective defiance. And we here are the collective defiance. And you and our doctoral students are the collective defiance. We are the bedrock of the Australian research community. You might just don't quite realise it yet, but you will. If I have a single purpose to achieve today, it is for everybody to realise that there's more than one way of being and knowing in the world, and that's okay. This is my grandmother's painting. We must never forget, as Aboriginal people, that we exist within deep, deep cosmologies and deep, deep knowledge systems. This is of a place called Umbluddawatch, which nobody would have heard of. It's like this tiny little town on the Sandover Highway, northeast of Alice Springs again, my country. This is my grandmother's painting, and it moves. The painting moves as the light hits it, just like the sand moves. So it means split hoof. And the knowledge of the movement of sand and dirt that happened when the cloven-hoofed animals hit that country is immense. And that's why I wanted to share it with you today. Our graduate school exists as a space where black excellence is our foundation, and we actively... I've come here from Alice Springs. I know what it is to be the butt of everybody's jokes. I know what it is to have a relentlessly negative narrative that is ruthlessly pushed. But we must never forget that we exist in these places of strength and pride. And we must never exist that we are the practitioners of today. We walk on the shoulders of our ancestors and those people that have come before us, and we pave the way for the next generation of researchers to come. So I ask all of you, as we sit and stand and talk here on this beautiful Kaurna country, to just stop and reflect for a second at the marvel of the land that surrounds us, at the marvel of the creators and the perfection of land and people. Wonder at the beauty, reflect on the ancestors and on the old people who were the first people, and know that as we participate in this knowledge exchange, we are participating in a continuum of knowledge sharing that goes back to the beginning of time. That's what we're doing here. And think about what knowledge it is that you and your institutions are sharing. And I'll send out a call right now for every university that you're coming from. You can come and engage with Bachelor. Our doors are open because we want to share our knowledge and our culture, and for all your Aboriginal students, but also for yourselves. There is a future ahead where I'm not the only Aboriginal person who's at ACGR, and I'm not the only Aboriginal person who... it's an open call. Bachelor's welcome. You guys come. Uncle John Wops, our cultural ambassador, he's our elder. When I say we're guided by elders, I'm not lying.
Came here, Catherine. English is my 8th language. It is important I explained the language I speak. I speak Mabuyag language. They're all terms up there of a language. Seungapa is a masculine term in Mabuyag language for welcome. Seungapa is a feminine term in Mabuyag language for welcome. Mayem is a term in the Eastern Islands of the Torres Strait. The Eastern Torres Strait Islanders use in the language called the Miriam language. Welcome. Welcome to you all. I think it is important for me to tell you where I am from, and especially with the visitors from overseas. I live on Waibe, Thursday Island. It is just near the tip of Cape York Peninsula to the south. My island is Mabuyag, in the middle of that map. Bordering us is Badu Island, Badulgal. My people are Gumulgal. We have this cultural alliance. We've been referred to as Malulgal, people of the sea. It was given to us by Saibalgal. Saibai is an island closer to the coastline of Papua New Guinea. It's about 3 to 4 kilometers of the coast. And I want to acknowledge the people of Thursday Island, Waibe, and we refer to them as Kaiwalgal. Ngailaka pasin kauna mabaika kui mabaigal matike de tanmun bradar matike de tanmun lagau dan laig matike de tanmun ya ngai apasin nitamunika ngau mabaigal matike de nitamun buai nitanga pamilagas. I'm humbled to acknowledge the Kaurna people, their land, their culture, and their language, and the interconnection with the other tribal and clan groups associated in this area or this region. This is our cultural emblem that we use when we welcome a space or invited to a space of another country. I also want to acknowledge you and your family connections. Family lineage connections is so important in this hustle and bustle of life. You must have that connection to give you the strength. The four women contributed to my life as I was growing up. Under the Act, it was a system introduced by the former Queensland government, legislated. The person on the left is my mother, who contributed so much of the cultural knowledge. In our worldview, it is the women that hold the knowledge. They are the cultural dictionaries. And I wrote a cultural protocol in Mabuyag and then in English. The other three are my aunties. They're all mothers to me. Because in that time, it was a bylaw under the Act that women have to be in the yard by 6 o'clock. Children have to be by bed by 9 o'clock. And the old village have to put out the light by 11 o'clock. So that is important, that we must continue to acknowledge the people before us. Yes, we were governed by the Department of Native Affairs. It was an administrative body to really police us, to see if we were doing the right things. I used to play with the children of the government teacher. That's the government teacher's house. But I was not allowed in the house. I only played for a little while, and then I was shushed away back to the village or to the community. I can tell you now, as a traditional owner, that land belonged to us. That land belonged to the Dugong clan, to the Panay clan of Mabuyag Island. Epistemic justice needs a collective approach. The definition states that we need the universal participation to equally collaborate knowledge so we can journey together. By collective knowledge, you will learn things like one person that was intrigued by a knowledge, an indigenous knowledge. Dr. Mary Ellen Weber, an American female astronaut who went up to space twice. She was intrigued by Auntie Mavis Barney's father's dance song of the shark constellation. There's a line in that song that I was able to interpret. And the line states that the composer could see that sign, the site of the constellation on a parallel vision. So when you dance the dance, you dance in parallel of the shark constellation. We call that shark Baidam in Mabuyag. Of course, in the Western science and in the night sky chart, we all know it is Ursa Major, the big bear or the greater bear. But for us, for Gumulgal, to Mabia people, it will always be the shark constellation. We need to look at things differently from now on. We need to make the change, and we need to have the collective approach in order to address the change. That is one way of looking at a coconut tree. I know that you have seen a coconut tree, but probably from a different angle. But we need that collective approach. We must sail the seas and walk the land, because we did continue to do that. In our language, we have words of other places, of other place names in Australia. We are only an island. I read a manuscript, Warrior's manuscript, written in 1898, 126 years ago, that stated that First Nation people of Australia did sail the seas and walk the land. Yes, sir, as well, thank you. Awesome. The next presenter is Maria.
Thank you, Uncle. Hi, everyone. My name is Maria Rossidi, and I'm co-director of the Indigenous and Transcultural Research Centre at University of the Sunshine Coast. I'm going to talk to you today about the topic of diversity, diversity in knowledge, as well as diversity amongst Indigenous students. Diversity in knowledge is not only desirable, but it's essential. We know that diverse knowledge will make us all win. It will provide us with wisdom collectively that will help us to solve the thorny, knotty issues of the 21st century. Diverse thinking is a catalyst for change, unlocking new ways to address the complexity, volatility, uncertainty, and ambiguity of our times. To unlock diverse knowledge first requires us to challenge the northern Western worldviews that dominate doctoral knowledge and doctoral knowledge production. By weaving together diverse knowledges, we can validate, extend, and enrich our collective wisdom. The notion of proper knowledge carries with it a sense of exclusivity, a privileging certain forms of knowledge and certain voices. However, we could reframe this to proper knowledge, proper being an Indigenous colloquial term for work that is done well, sensitively, with collaboration and consultation. By reframing knowledge production as proper knowledge construction, we can recognise diverse ways of knowing, being and doing. Now, for most scholars, northern Western dominance of how knowledge is created is hidden. It's made invisible by our efficient research training that often ignores key questions about how knowledge is produced, what counts, and why this is so. Consequently, it's not really a surprise that our research training produces academics with a limited research toolkit who then replicate Northern Western knowledge dominance through their supervision. Now, universities are great places. They offer lots of opportunities for Indigenous peoples, but there's also an undercurrent of constraints around these. On one hand, universities provide platforms for Indigenous voices to be heard, provide opportunities for identity discovery and affirmation, but they're also places that it can exert pressure on Indigenous peoples to perform in certain ways, if you like, the imagined Indigenous student, and those ways are constructed by the institution. For many Indigenous students, Aboriginality means that they have fragmented histories, and colonial practices such as the stolen generations and certificates of exemption have left deep wounds amongst Indigenous communities, and they have profoundly shaped Aboriginal identity and how Aboriginal people are perceived and experienced. Some students, our doctoral students, are still growing into their Aboriginality. Indigenous students have many interests, like all students, but there's this undercurrent, this sense of performing, the sense that the only topics that they're interested in are Indigenous topics. And I talk from experience. As an Indigenous person, my main research area, my love and passion and my training is in marketing. And as I've become older, I've grown into Indigenous research areas. I put that together because it's important to realise that sometimes we might use student first language, students who are Indigenous, perhaps, rather than Indigenous students. So while identity is critical for Indigenous students' identity and their well-being, their cultural heritage should not constrain the topics they choose or how the university perceives them. So look, together, let's weave Indigenous knowledges and create this diverse knowledge system. Together, let's recognise that undercurrent of pressures and the imagined Aboriginal student by placing them in positions or making assumptions about their interests and topics. And let's reconstruct, perhaps, the idea of the Indigenous student as a student who is Indigenous. Thank you. I now have the honour of passing on to Hinikura Smith, who will provide us with an Aotearoa New Zealand perspective.
You've got about 2 seconds to tune into the New Zealand accent, because I've got a lot to say in a really short time to do it, so let's crack on, eh? Let's crack on. Māori doctoral successes Māori encourages Māori doctoral students to bring their identity, language and protocols to the research journey. For some, the PhD is a space to strengthen their cultural identity and understand this as a strength, rather than irrelevant and unnecessary in the assumed acultural world of academia. A Māori-centric approach to doctoral success in Aotearoa New Zealand is by Māori for Māori and has language practices and aspirations at its centre. It's about understanding who we are first and then our connections to a wider global and transcultural set of research relations. All those up, shall we? Te kupinga o mai, MAI, our acronym for Māori and Indigenous, draws on the concept of a network that is transdisciplinary, interinstitutional and international. Māori emerged in the early 2000s through the collaborative effort of some of our scholarly rock stars like Linda Tuhiwai Smith, Graham Smith and Leonie Pihama, beginning with sites across 8 Aotearoa New Zealand universities with a goal of graduating 500 Māori PhDs within 10 years. We blew this out of the water in under 5. The MAI network now has 13 sites extending beyond the universities to include the vocational sector, independent Māori research centres and a tribal college. Membership is voluntary and it's free, and we have over 450 Māori and Indigenous doctoral students within the network. Activities include workshops, online events, guest speakers, writing retreats and the much anticipated annual national MAI conference. Important to MAI is the I. We welcome Indigenous doctoral students who are committed to a treaty relationship in research. That is, they are Indigenous researchers working on country Aotearoa lands and as such come into special relationship with Māori. We have over 100 students from the Pacific, South America, Hawaii, Taiwan, First Nations and North America. Mai has nurtured relationships with our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island relations and have been honoured to host students from UQ, Melbourne and Macquarie at our last two Mai conferences. They're a real crack up actually, they're lots of fun, they've got to come back. And grown Indigenous doctoral research conditions nationally as a national network transcends discipline and institutional silos and enables early research collaborations that extend post-PhD. You might think that an initiative like Mai that has changed the landscape of Māori research for almost a quarter of a century would be centrally funded and fully supported. It is not. In brief, universities receive funding from the Tertiary Education Council upon successful completion of a doctoral degree. A Māori student is funded double, a non-Māori student, and a thesis that is written in Te Reo Māori, Māori language, receives four times the funding. This is an excellent incentive to grow research capacity in Māori language scholarship, and rightly so, in line with the university's rhetoric about equitable outcomes for Māori. There is, however, no directive about how universities should invest this funding. The only funding that the Mai Network receives is through the Māori Centre of Research Excellence, and it's about between $10,000 and $15,000 a year. Not much. Really, it's run on what we call aroha, which is, you know, the smell of an oily rag and the love for the initiative, and requires a lot of cultural taxation. Despite Mai's contribution to growing much-needed Māori academic capacity for the tertiary sector, at very little cost, I might add, Māori-only or Māori equity programs remain precarious. Here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, October the 14th, 2023, marked a dark day in Indigenous advancement. On the same day that the Voice referendum was voted down, a sharp swing to the political right in Aotearoa, New Zealand, saw the formation of a three-party coalition who have boldly enacted both implicit and explicit anti-Māori policy. The immediate, immediate disestablishment of a Māori health authority and a number of policies that seek to remove the right of Māori as First Nations and Indigenous in Aotearoa. The current One Nation agenda sits in direct conflict with the treaty obligations signed between Māori and the Crown in 1840. The furthest right of the coalition partners is pushing for a referendum to remove and redefine the principles of our treaty, in effect removing Māori again as the Indigenous people. While globally Indigenous may look to Aotearoa around language revitalisation and education models, we once again find ourselves in cultural and political precarity. It's a grave reminder that until there is a serious attempt to address systemic and societal racism, equity initiatives such as Mai, double funding, Māori dedicated spaces in universities and much more can be defunded by the stroke of the policy pen. What keeps Māori, kaupapa Māori initiatives such as Mai to support doctoral success active and activist is that it is grounded in relationships that transcend institutions and nation boundaries. As Rangi Nui Walker, one of our eminent Māori scholars, reminded us in the 90s, ka whawhai tonu tātou, we continue to fight. Kia ora koutou.
Never a fan of a tall podium. I think I'll need my grandmother's stool to be able to see everyone here. Hi, yeah. My name is Jing Chi. I am a senior lecturer at the RMIT University. I came to Australia in 2010 as an international student, and since then I've been living in the Darug land in Western Sydney and the Wurundjeri lands in Victoria. I'm going to get out of this. Okay. All right, so Joe and I identify ourselves as members of the transcultural doctoral education communities in Australia. We use the term transcultural to emphasize the dynamic blending that occurs when the ideas, influences, practices, and beliefs of different cultures converge in a specific setting, text, or contact zone.
We consider transcultural students as encompassing international doctoral students, domestic students from culturally diverse backgrounds, as well as culturally diverse refugee students. So the presence of international doctoral students in Australian doctoral education has been steadily increasing. Many arrive with misconceptions about Australia as a predominantly white country. The first awakening often comes with the acknowledgement of country. Until recently, Indigenous Australian histories were not compulsory learning content in Australian doctoral education programs. It was typically left to doctoral supervisors to address this gap. However, at my university, at RMIT, it became a compulsory module for all commencing doctoral students last year. Yay. So my point is that truth-telling about Australia's First Nations histories within doctoral education is crucial, not only for acknowledging colonial injustices in the past, but also for strengthening the fundamental principles of our role as researchers. Because truth forms the bedrock of research and science. As researchers, our foundations are shaky right now because one of the Australians' fundamental truths is not widely established. International doctoral students' misconception about Australia is just one example of the disconnections between First Nations and transcultural communities in Australia. The Voice referendum has highlighted various forms of disconnections between First Nations and transcultural communities in Australia. The lack of knowledge about transcultural communities, about First Nations histories and communities, prompts us to... So the lack of knowledge among transcultural communities about First Nations histories and communities prompts us to consider how research training and doctoral education might facilitate future connections through alternative knowledge production practices. Decades of undervaluing First Nations and migrant community languages in knowledge production and dissemination processes in Australia have led to mistranslation, misinterpretation, and misinformation, as well as disinformation about the Voice referendum and First Nations peoples in general. Bridging these disconnections requires more than a few months of yes campaigning. These disconnections have been perpetuated by existing knowledge hierarchies to favor Eurocentric knowledges, marginalize other knowledge systems, and separate marginalized communities. First Nations communities and transcultural communities do not engage in enough dialogues with each other. Therefore, there's a need to reimagine doctoral education in Australia. Placing Indigenous knowledges at the center needs to be a guiding principle that promotes equitable access to and meaningful engagement with knowledges from marginalized communities. This principle can inspire us as transcultural doctoral students and supervisors to transcend privileged knowledge systems and incorporate marginalized knowledge systems and prompt the dialogues between each other. In one of our articles, we argued for a histories of knowledges approach into doctoral education, and I would like to share that at last with you. This approach emphasizes four sets of epistemic relations, the distinction between the history and knowledge and histories of knowledges, the relationship between the history of knowledge and the history of science, the connections between mobile knowledges, and the factors influencing knowledge hierarchies, dominance, and precariousness. We hope the histories of knowledges approach can function as a meta-epistemological lens, stimulating our participants' reconsideration of knowledges and knowledge productions as multilingual, transcultural, and also from Southern perspectives. Thank you very much. Yeah. I now pass my... Yeah, I can stick to our PhD student, Jiao. Yeah.
Hello, everyone. My name is Jiao Tuxworth, and you can also call me Wang Meng Jiao. I'm a PhD candidate at University of Sunshine Coast, and my PhD project looks at the experiences of culturally and linguistically diverse music teachers in Australian school. When I was young, people told me Australia is a Western country. I look at my map and feel confused. Geographically, it's not self-explanatory. And then, when I first traveled to Australia, studying my master's degree in music, I did believe Australia is a Western country, dominated by Western knowledge and culture. Just like many countries in Europe, even so, we have very visually, racially, and linguistic diverse population. And later, I studied another master's degree in a different university in Australia, majored in school teaching. And that made me deeply believe Australia is a Western country. Just like the UK, but with a better weather. In a course called Understanding Diverse Learners, Indigenous students and students from culturally and linguistic diverse background were perceived as a problem that is difficult to deal with. And as an introvert, INTJ, Asian student, I did not question. I know there are a lot of people who, like me, came to Australia as an international student or skilled migrant. When we arrived here, people told us a lot of negative things about Indigenous people in Australia. And we do not know why, but we did not question. And we believed it without understanding and knowing the real history in Australia, the full picture, and what is behind this. During the referendum vote, I was the minority in my Chinese friends group who supported yes. And when I went to conferences, invited other international students, international PhD students, to an Indigenous music station, Indigenous cultural station, they were completely disengaged. There was a disconnection between the Indigenous history, culture, and international PhD student. They do not know why they need to acknowledge country and knowing the Aboriginal history in Australia in a white society. And no one explained to them why. I mean, they are a group of smart people and they can make positive change in Australia. But they just don't understand why. That's why it's very important to implement Indigenous knowledge at higher education level, because people at their 20s, 30s, or even older can't go back to secondary school or primary school to relearn those things. And that's a smart group we don't want to give up. By letting all cultural groups knowing that Australia is an Aboriginal land based with contributions from all cultural groups, we can unite people together as we have a shared belief. And that's what can hold people together in a society that has increasingly culturally diverse population. Thanks, everyone. And let's welcome to you.
Thanks very much. It's a great privilege to be here and to share the panel with Catherine and all the colleagues. So we are going to now switch tack a little bit and speak about the doctorate in South Africa, looking at context, coloniality, knowledge systems, and identity. And I want to introduce my colleagues who are with me today, Moira Keane, Beatrice Akala, and Halima Namakula, who's not with us, but who is part of the presentation. And we all come from the University of Johannesburg in South Africa. So maybe a bit by just establishing the context in South Africa and the context of doctoral production. I think the big issue, as you all know, is that we've had 30 years of democracy in South Africa, but the current political economy of South Africa continues to be characterized by high Gini coefficients, the measure of inequality, And this continues to be replicated in race and gender patterns. At the same time, there are ambitions around, you know, robust human capital development and economic growth. What has been really important is in the last 20 or 30 years, we've seen increased access into higher education, particularly into universities, and we now have about 1.1 million students in universities. However, we also have a faltering post-education and schooling sector with few meaningful labor market opportunities, with youth unemployment standing at about 42%, so those who are not in universities. So like a number of developing countries, we have massified higher education with increased access, but throughput and success continues to be low. At the same time, ambitions and actual practice don't align, and the ambition of our national development plan is to have 5,000 doctoral students graduations by 2030, but currently this stands at 3,500. We have 26 universities in South Africa of various types. So South Africa is seen very much as the doctoral hub for doctoral education in Africa. And the profile in South Africa is that we have about 23,000 doctoral enrollments. We had 3,500 doctoral graduations in 2020. 33% of our students are international, and these are mainly from the rest of Africa, and the gender breakdown is we have about 52% male doctoral students and 48% female, which sort of shifts every now and then. But what's really important, I think, is to establish the context in Africa. And in the 1990s and the early 2000s, we saw an attempt to really revitalize the higher education sector through expansion and diversification. And the debates and discourses around the knowledge society and the knowledge economy took root. The main levers for establishing this new knowledge system has been human capital development, technological advancement, innovation and research. And much of this is based on the premise that there would be expansion of the higher education postgraduate sector. But as in a number of countries, there's been a lot of policy, there's been a lot of review, there's been a lot of planning, but implementation has been slow. But I think there is agreement that we need tens of thousands of more doctoral graduates in Africa. The ecosystem continues to be have some challenges. There's a lack of funding for research and doctoral studies. They're competing national and regional priorities within a limited education fiscus. The size of the postgraduate pipeline, so the number of master's students being produced in order to enter doctoral studies continues to be low. Most of our students that we work with at UJ and other places are part-time as opposed to full-time, and there is a real attempt to move towards supervision capacity and issues of bandwidth and a limited infrastructure. I'm not going to dwell on that given time, but just to say one of the big concerns continues to be the issue of brain circulation and brain drain, that a lot of students come study in other countries and then don't return to Africa. But our presentation today is really about decolonizing the curriculum in higher education and whose knowledge matters, which my colleagues will speak to. So in the last 10 years, we've seen a crisis in the academy and lots of discussions about the modern university, which requires a rethinking of worldviews and practice, the way in which disciplinary knowledge is organized. How do we create ontologies and epistemologies to become truly representative of Africa and the global South? We've also witnessed the devastating humanitarian crisis in Gaza, and we've seen huge differences in the responses between the North and the South to this. The call for decolonization higher education in Africa has been going on for many decades, but in South Africa it was foregrounded during the students' protests during 2015, which are still ongoing, and which is called, which are referred to often as the fees must fall. And within this context, obviously, there are big concerns about continued coloniality, which shapes supervision practices and the kind of knowledge the doctoral students engage with. Against this background, in South Africa, there are a number of important initiative discourses, changing narratives, which foreground innovations being presented. And I now hand over to Moira Keane to speak to these.
Good morning, colleagues, friends. I'm very humbled to be here and grateful to everyone who's made this possible. I acknowledge our elders here. There are some parallels between what our colleagues, Maria, for example, has said and the situation in South Africa. So I jump right in following a question from one of our elders, and Lovo Gacheni, who asks, is what we teach liberating? And we extend this to, is the knowledge that doctoral students create liberating for themselves and for their communities? So what does transformation and decolonization mean for doctoral education? And not just in the South African context, but I'm beginning to understand there's a lot more in common across our context, even though the situations are different. So in South Africa, while a great deal of research has been done in Indigenous knowledge, as Shireen has already told us, the students still feel outraged, alienated, and don't always have a sense of belonging. There's still a Western knowledge hegemony. So while democracy has indeed brought significant changes, it has to a large extent, and I know some of my colleagues from South Africa who have written about this, embraced the liberal Western worldview with its capitalist processes, which really come into our universities. So taking the original ideals of our transformation to democracy, one aspect has been the inclusion of Indigenous knowledge systems. And this was introduced as policy in 2004, and aiming mostly for... Oh, I forgot to carry on. Sorry. There's our policy. At redress for knowledges that had been marginalized, to promote an affirmation of African cultures, and to develop in a more practical way services of traditional healers and knowledge holders. But there have been lapses in the redress in reaching higher education. And I think similarly, to what our younger colleagues have said, that doctoral students are often just on their way to go to get a qualification, and not necessarily, for various reasons, interested or aware of the changing policies. So what can we do on in a practical level? I'm arguing that as far as the thesis is concerned, we can look more carefully at the purpose, the knowledge purpose, the canon, who we reading, who we accessing for knowledge, kind of worldview, inclusion of spirit, disrupting conventional methodologies, reconsidering ethics, African languages. There have been some theses written in African languages, not many, relationality, positionality, and then how is the knowledge shared? Who is acknowledged in the sharing? But not everyone is going to be doing work in that area, so I'm also saying that supervisors and doctoral candidates, while working largely in a particular knowledge system, should at least be aware of the validity and potential of other knowledge systems that contribute to human flourishing. And I'll end with Catherine Odora Hoppers, who says the path forward is not about becoming more clever, it's about becoming more human. Thank you.
Morning, colleagues. Thank you, Shireen and Moira. My name is Beatrice Akala, originally from Kenya, but working and living in South Africa. So I'm going to discuss the identity question and looking at a case of black female doctoral students in South Africa. We recognize that a lot has happened through the transformation that happened in 1994, but still the issue of black identity is still drawing a lot of attention, especially in the project that we are involved in. And we are arguing that black identity or black female identity is nuanced, is fluid, is multiple, and therefore we do not envision homogenizing black identity. We see that the female doctoral students have multiple identities. We have students who are wives, who are mothers, that are also pursuing their studies, their sisters, community members, and they belong to various religious affiliations. And in this case, we view intersectionality as a framework that is adequate to be able to understand the multiple identities that the black female doctoral students bring to the academy. And we are arguing that gender intersects fundamentally with other identities, that would be your race identity, social class, your culture, your language, and this ends up producing different subjective positions. And with this in mind, we therefore argue that their experience in the academy and is informed by the intersectionality or the multiple identities that they embody. We also argue that when these identities are misrecognized, we end up having female students feeling alienated due to institutionalized racism and sexism. We see how the ideologies of sexism and racism converge to reproduce gendered and inferior experiences. And one of our colleagues has written a very good and interesting piece that is based on her experience in teaching of mathematics. And she argues that her work is seen as just being a woman. And what do women know in mathematics anyway? So we see how these ideologies converge to reproduce gendered and inferiorized kind of experiences. In our case, we also see a gap in the lack of articulation of what transformation really should mean, and we see that even the measurements that are used to be able to talk about what transformation has taken place are kind of lacking, because the indicators often ignore the intersectional and gendered disadvantage that women in doctoral students bring to the fore. Therefore, the issue of greater access and success remains a point of contention, because that when you look at equitable access, we also need to be arguing that it has led to equitable success, but that seems to be a point of contention. Just thinking about or reflecting on the disadvantages of being black and female pursuing a doctoral education in South Africa, we argue that we need to have a more holistic way of mapping and expressing what transformation really means in the context of South Africa. And we argue that we need to move towards more plural and multiple voices, looking at different sides of knowledge production and looking at the gender periphery kind of debates, whose knowledge is at the center, who is at the periphery, and how can we move our dots around to make sure that the black female experience in higher education is more productive. However, we also notice that although we have all these disadvantages, the black female doctoral students succeed anyway in their studies, and we attribute this to agency and resilience. And we also see that institutional support plays a very important role. Peer support is also very important, and those lead to achievement in doctoral studies. Finally, our colleague Halima was not able to be around today. She had recorded an epilogue that we are not able to play, but she was going to speak about epistemicide and epistemic justice in black doctoral studies. So with that, we come to an end, and thank you so much for listening to us.
They're all just too deadly, aren't they? Okay. So we did want to have some time for questions, even though we were trying to be super fast with so many speakers. So, and I believe there are roving mics. Pardon? A couple of minutes. Yeah. Okay, just a few questions. Looks like we've floored you. All right, well, we might keep to time, and I would just want to once again... Sorry, there is a question. Sorry.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Jo Ferry. I'm from the University of Glasgow in Scotland, and I wonder if anybody could say a little bit more about how you're moving forward with the kind of research methods training in order to acknowledge multiple ways of knowing.
Sure. So, at Bachelor, we have come to the conclusion that we are just enough. So, we are better than enough. So, we privilege all of our research training program. We start with Indigenous knowledges. We start with acknowledging that. And then, do you know, we've got such good scholarship now that we don't actually need to look to the, you know, dead French society necessarily, because we've got our own internal scholarship, knowings. And so, I mean, we completely privilege everything, but we also are really happy to share that. So, I don't know, naively I have a belief that all doctoral education is strengthened when it comes from this place. And so we would happily share all of that. You know, maybe a project like this can launch a movement that says when you do privilege Indigenous knowledges as the start of all of your research training program, we don't know what the outcome can be. So, yes, we've certainly made steps towards embedding it across all of our training, our research training program, but, you know, to create an opportunity to share that with everybody else as well.
Same question, yeah. So we have, along the three research projects that we have been doing as a team, we've used two different sections in terms of first one, tracing the historical transnational knowledge exchange, and the second part is enabling transcultural and multilingual knowledge co-construction. So an example of the first section was that in our workshops we would be kind of presenting, for example, the six schools of Chinese thought before the Han Dynasty, talking about how, you know, that was a time when 1,000 flowers blossomed. There were so many different, you know, diverse ways of knowing, thinking, and living. But then we ask a key question, that is, how did Confucianism then become the cultural orthodox in China? What actually happened? So we engage our students in that critical reflection. But also we talk about examples like how, you know, German scholars brought different, you know, theoretical schools of thoughts to the United States during the Second World War, and how that kind of enabled transnational knowledge exchange and the research culture in the United States in general. So by doing that, we try to enable our doctoral students or doctoral candidates to think about, all right, historically, knowledge construction has never been monolingual or Eurocentric. It has always been enriched interculturally and transculturally. And then they can go on thinking about, all right, how can my other language, my multiple identities, my different family histories, cultural histories, geographical histories, help in my thesis writing. Yeah. Okay.
So, question up the back.
Thank you. My question is addressed to Associate Professor Mary from Bachelor in she's from Northern Territory. If I'm not mistaken, I saw your slides. Mentioned about some of the countries, but I don't know if anyone here knows historically who is the first nation or first country arrived in Australia back in 15th century. It's actually our ancestors from Indonesia. So I'd like to share this knowledge to everyone. If you want to go and Google it, who's actually arrived in Australia for the very first time, and we had a lot of transcultural connections between Northern Territory people and Makassar, because that's where I come from, Makassar, Indonesia. So just to share this knowledge, I think this is important for future doctoral students who are interested to study about this as well. So apart from other countries that you mentioned in your slide, thank you very much.
Absolutely. The Trepang trade, there are multiple words that spread all the way down to the country, even in Aranda and Aoyawada, there are shared words from trading. So, yes, I agree completely, and everybody should know that too.
I'm going to have to interrupt and call us to towards the tea break and to give people a chance to refresh themselves before we start again at 11. But could I thank you very, very much, Catherine and colleagues. I've really enjoyed that. Stunning. Stunning.